Silence!
Oppenheimer!
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerd Pride Radio!
Nerd alert!
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to... All right, let's try it again. And welcome to episode 51 of Nerd Pride Radio. 51, well, all right, 51 is 17 times 3, so it's a bi-prime, but that's boring. Area 51, nerd stuff, blah, 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 aliens, government cover-up, sure. But most excitingly... 51 represents, for me, the 51st state of these United States of America. Do you have any idea how close we are to having a 51st state? Sometime back when I was in elementary school, I mean, this was literally in the 70s, I had a teacher who told us that, oh, yeah, eventually we'll have another state. We'll probably have multiple more states. It just happens, because these were teachers who had grown up seeing in their lifetime, you know, after decades of 48 states. They had seen Alaska and Hawaii come in as states, and they're like, oh, yeah, it'll happen. Probably Puerto Rico, you bet. All right, that was 40 years ago I was told that. And now I've been following it, and I've always been excited because every year Puerto Rico takes a vote on hey, is it time to become a state? You think this is it? You know, and it's like every year that vote gets a little bit closer and a little bit closer. I've always been a little excited about that idea that, hey, it's going to happen. And you know what? It happened in 2012. What, I'm just looking this up because of the number 51. And in 2012, in 2012, they wound up voting, majority of the citizens of Puerto Rico voted that, yeah, you know what, it's time we became a state. And so why aren't they a state yet? Why aren't we even really in the process? I mean, they sent it for referral over to the Congressional Budget Office, and the nonpartisan review by the CBO tells us that, you know what? If Puerto Rico becomes a state, this can only profit the citizens of Puerto Rico. Puerto Rico and all of its people are better off as a result financially. They will make more money being part of the United States. And, oh, guess what? The United States will make more money by having Puerto Rico there. It's a win-win for everybody involved. They've done the analysis and said, you know what? Let's move forward with this. So why haven't we? You know why? Oh, because inertia is so powerful. Because within Puerto Rico and interests involved in Puerto Rico, there's always people who are making money off the status quo. They make money because the system is set up right now for them to make money. And even though overall everyone may benefit, well, these are people who have money and they don't want things to change. And so it's slow. And so is it going to happen? God, I hope so. Why? Well, okay, yeah, sure, it's supposed to be good for everybody, but more than that, wouldn't that be cool? Well, I mean, look, if it's going to benefit everybody anyway, wouldn't it be cool? A way to get young people interested in civics and in government and in history? How does that not grab your attention? That, oh my God, we have a new state? It's been like 50 years. Have we got a new state? That would be so exciting. And yet, oh, they're dragging their feet about it. God, I hope this thing happens. I really do. I really do. But anyway, I completely sidetracked off my intro. I meant to put all that Puerto Rico stuff later in the show. But ask me how I'm doing today. Go on. Ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones. I am a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, a comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's like 7 other kinds of nerd. I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio. This is the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my skull anymore. Oh, our sponsor this week is Thistletop Construction for all your fantasy building needs. You in the market for mazes, bridges, fortresses? Then go to thistletopconstruction.com and get yourself an estimate. You will not be sorry. All right, starting off this show, updates. I'm sorry, I'm moving quick because I'm excited. Under updates, I talked to you guys at least two or three times about my brother's book, Norn's Quest, The Norn's Quest by Kyle Jones. My brother wrote a fantasy novel, a young adult post-apocalyptic dystopian sort of thing, and it's amazing. It's a really good book. My brother is really good at what he does. I've told you this many times. Well, right now, over at indieauthorland.com, they have it's an open for voting for the 50 self-published books most worth reading. And quick tangent, I just put it on pause. I'm getting sick, and so my voice is off. I don't know if you can hear it or not. I've got a cough. I am working this cough button like crazy, because otherwise I'm not going to make it through this podcast. But just now, I paused it because the phone is ringing in the other room. I'm off today because it's Arbor Day, and no self-respecting Nebraska state government employee would work on Arbor Day, for God's sake. But my wife and kids are in school, and so I assumed it was probably my wife calling. So I put the podcast on pause, take time away from you lovely people. I go running to the other room to grab the phone, and I just barely missed it. And as I'm looking at the caller ID, it's from Brooklyn, New York. It's, oh, God, it was a telemarketer. Damn it, I'm so sorry I missed that. God, if I had known it was a telemarketer, I would have just answered it live on the phone here so you guys can hear how I do that, because I love telemarketers. It's awesome. In fact, I told you a while back that I keep getting someone calling in to say, oh, you know, there's something wrong with your computer. You know, if you really just log into this site, give us your credit card number, we can get you fixed up on this, blah, blah, blah. I love those guys. You know why? Because I have no compunctions about telling them that they're horrible people to their faces. Because they know they're lying and stealing and cheating. I mean, even if they're being hired as a phone operator for some crooked company, and they're reading a script and stealing money for other people, they know what they're doing as they're doing it. So I have no problem with telling them off. But God, I'm so sorry I missed this one. From Brooklyn, New York. Too bad. Anyway, where I left off was, my brother is an awesome author. He wrote a book called The Norn's Quest. If you go over to indieauthorland.com. And I know I could just provide a link, couldn't I? I never remember to do that. Go over to indieauthorland.com, and right there at the top, you click on the link that says Book Lover, and it'll drop down a menu to 50 self-published books worth reading, and go to the fantasy category and vote for Norn's Quest by Kyle Jones. All right. Well, first, go get his book off of Amazon. If you're an Amazon Prime member, you can borrow it for free. Otherwise, it'll cost like $2. It's worth your time. Maybe three. I don't remember what it costs anymore. It's a great book. And if you haven't read it, you really should. And then once you've read it, then go over to Indie Authorland and vote for my brother. And then tomorrow, go back and vote for him again, because their website says vote early, vote often. They don't mind multiple votes. Keep on doing this. Really, this site, as I just pointed out to somebody else, this site, it's just a matter of who can mobilize the biggest fan base to support their book. And if you're a self-published author, showing that you can mobilize a fan base to support you because your book is that good, that's a valuable measure for them. I don't know what's going to come out of this for my brother, but the voting is open until May 18th of 2014. So get over there, read Norn's Quest, vote for Norn's Quest, support my brother because he is awesome. I'm really, really excited for him. I'm so proud of this book. This is really cool stuff. But anyway, enough about updates. You know what it's time for? The meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me when I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, or in this case, 2 weeks, I add it to my master list, and then the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. All right. I have so much stuff on my master list, I don't even know what to do with it all. I skipped last week, stuff came up, things happened. I didn't even put out any bonus episodes, and so without that release valve to get all the excess off my list, it has stacked up. So I've got a handful of things here today. Hopefully, I'll get some time this weekend because all of our scout events for the weekend were canceled. Bizarre. We had this jam-packed weekend. I mean, beginning to end, it was going to be stuff going on. We had, you know, Easter to celebrate out with the in-laws, and then there was a scout academic event where they were going to earn some belt loops and pins and do some fun activities over at the college, and then there was a scout camp out that was going to happen, and I mean, it was just, this is going to be a jam-packed weekend, and as it turned out, we get an email that says, oh yeah, you know what, for lack of turnout, even though the weather is gorgeous, it's going to be like 80 degrees, because of lack of turnout, we're canceling the camping trip. Sorry about that. Like, all right, well, you know, we still got the academic day. We'll go do that. We'll have some fun. It'll be like, you know, 5 hours, 6 hours on a Saturday, and, you know, we'll have a good time. And then we got an email that said, nope, sorry, due to lack of response, we're canceling academic day. I'm like, really? I'm like, all right, well, cool. That'll give me more time to play some Pathfinder with my kids and maybe even record some bonus episodes if I get some time. That would be awesome, wouldn't it? Because I have got to clear out this master list. And the very first thing I've got on this master list is something from my gaming table. I've got Dungeon Master's Guide. I've got 12-sided die. Role-playing games, video games, card games, if it's on my gaming table, then I am coming here to share it with you guys. And you know what I got to talk about this week? Pathfinder. I have been playing so much Pathfinder, it's not even funny. Oh, Pathfinder has got to be my favorite role-playing game of all time. It really is. And you know what? Actually, that's unfair. I mean, when you say favorite role-playing game of all time, so often, really, the game itself is irrelevant. The system, the rules itself are really irrelevant. I mean, you know, you need a decent system, but it's really about the people you get to play with and the stories you get to tell and the fun you get to make. I mean, you can take any crappy game and turn it into a really good time. As long as you got the right group of friends around you. Or you can have virtually no game. I've done that where we've sat down with some of the online games we played, where we played in story system, we played with instant game, where we come to the table with nothing prepared. We get in there and the rules are sketchy at best, but it doesn't matter because we're all committed to making a good story. And that's what this is. And Pathfinder, in the last 6 months, has created more opportunities for me to tell fun stories and play awesome games with my family and friends than anything else ever. I'm having so much fun with it. Real quick, and I know I've talked about it before. You guys are going to have to put up with me because I love Pathfinder. I've been playing in the Rise of the Rune Lords game that's being run by Darks. Darks has, you know, thank you, Darks. Bless you. I'm so grateful for this game. He's been running the Rise of the Rune Lords adventure path from Paizo. And we're still second level. Probably, I'm, don't tell Darks, but I'm suspecting that right after this next set of encounters, I think we're going to hit third level. I'm really excited about that. Don't tell him I'm on to him though. And, having a great time. I'm playing again, my teenage bard character. She's Taylor Swift, basically, half orc. And we're having a great time. Just so much fun with this because we've got a really strong group of people where, you know, we're all adults, we're all experienced role players. We've got a lot of character development, a lot of interrelationship things, a lot of back and forth. So we're getting lots of great battles right now. Oh, we played last night, and I was up till 2 a.m. with this. We played last night and we wound up, which I could do because, you know, Arbor Day, don't have to work today, got to sleep in. And we had to leave off right in the middle of a battle. We're battling a goblin druid and a bunch of goblin dogs, and we just killed the druid's animal companion cat thingy. And here I am. Finally, I'm in a position where I can shoot this stupid druid in the face, and we have to leave off. Oh, man. So end on a cliffhanger. We'll pick up next time. But having a good time. Stan has been nice enough to run an alternate campaign for us on the off weeks when we're not doing Rune Lords. And that one was intended as a one-shot. So the whole plan was you're going to come in. We've got this goofy mission with a goofy setup and goofy characters. I mean, it's serious stuff, but it's played. I don't know if this is how Stan intended it, but we all kind of took a really lighthearted tone when we started, so it's become a lot of comedy. I mean, this could have been a very serious and scary thriller sort of dungeon had we entered into it with a different tone, but because we all kind of went in goofing around, that we've got some really messed up characters. All of us have weak spots, and so we went in with this comedy attitude, and we've been joking around about it. Oh my God, we've been having so much fun. And that one, I have a really soft spot in my heart for this game now. It's called The Cost of Magic, by the way. That's the name of the campaign. I've got a soft spot for it because the last session, he intended this to be just one or two sessions. This is going to be a one-off. We'll be done. We actually finished up our fifth session last time, and next week we'll play session number six, which will absolutely be the final one. I mean, we're right there at the end, boss. We just discovered what we need to do. Solutions are laid out in front of us if we can survive it. So this will be cool. But I've got a soft spot in my heart for this campaign because the way the last one ended, I completely, by random, fluke, stupid accident, had my character stumble into the solution to everything by a stupid wishing well. I mean, I honestly, we were so frustrated, and my character in particular, I was just kicking around, getting all pissed off at everything. And so I went down to the stupid wishing well in the basement, and I threw in a coin, and I just wished to be at the end boss. And holy crap, I was. And so, I mean, and I can't even tell you how scared I was. Because, I mean, to me, as a player, I'm realizing that, okay, this is the end boss, and I'm aware that this end boss is designed with the idea that a party of seven adventurers is going to come in and try and take it down. So it's designed for, you know, six or seven of us all at once, and I'm stuck in this room completely alone facing off with this thing, and I have absolutely no way of getting the other people in here. I don't even know where I am for sure. And fortunately, survived by the skin of my teeth. I mean, and I am broken, and I am scared to death, and oh, thank God, I think everybody else is going to be able to come to my rescue here in just 2 seconds, but that's where we left off. So, really cool game. So much fun. And then, of course, as you know, I'm playing with my kids, and we've been doing this pickup thing where, you know, it's my kids. They're here in the house all the time. So, I mean, Wednesday night, everyone got all their homework done early. We've got an hour before bedtime. Well, all right, as a reward, who wants to sit down and play Pathfinder? We have 45 minutes. Let's go. And so we'll sit down, we'll play Pathfinder. 45 minutes is just enough for one encounter or, you know, a string of conversations and getting to this next objective or just something simple and quick. And so we've been playing two or three times a week, just squeezing it in here and there when we've got time. And since there's no scouts this weekend, holy crap, I think we're going to do a big session tomorrow. This is my 10-year-old. That's his dream. He loves the, oh, come on. Can't we play those long games like you used to do with the older boys? Can't we play those long games like you did when you were in college where we sit down, we play for 8 hours straight? I'm like, well, all right, I'm not going to do 8 hours straight. That is way too taxing for me at this age. But yeah, if we can squeeze in like a 3 or 4 hour game this weekend, oh, I would love that. I've got some stuff, kind of notes jotted down for things I wanted to talk about in the gaming table this week, but I'm just going to kind of meander. So, you know, deal with it. And eventually we'll feel like there's some sort of resolution and I'll move on to the next thing. But what I was telling people online is this game with my kids is working out really well because I went back to my roots of Dungeons & Dragons. I went back to the stuff that made me and all of my friends fall in love with D&D back when we were 12 years old, when we were 13 years old. And it is a string of random encounters. Does that sound stupid? But that's what it is, that they get into a situation and things lead logically one to the next. And I'm tying them together with an overarching storyline. But really, it's not even... I'm not trying to create this massive world-spanning plot. I'm not trying to create this, yeah, because this is what I've gotten down to with my kids in the last, you know, decade that I've been playing with them, is I keep coming up with these huge worlds and wanting to create this huge adventure arc and looking forward to, okay, if they recover all the pieces of this artifact and they can bring all of it together and they can, you know, and I have these grand villains in the background and all these political machinations going on and all that. I'm like, that's an awful lot of work. And really, what my kids want to do is they just want to be cool. They just want to be really cool. And that's what they're doing. And this is not to say that this is just a completely disconnected set of plot points. It's working together, but we're just kind of letting the plot evolve as we go. They wound up, you know, Story opens with them waking up as slaves in some dark elf city, drow city, deep under the earth. And so they wake up as slaves and they have to find a way to escape. And in my mind, I had this idea that, okay, you know, they'll wind up escaping from their masters here. They'll make their way into the dark elf city, and then we'll have adventures of them trying to establish themselves in this city, you know, as escaped slaves, so that they can acquire equipment and build contacts and find some way out of here. And it was going to be really dark and gritty, and it just didn't wind up going that way. They wound up instead, they wind up meeting with some dark elf cleric sorceress who's been in a magical sleep for years. This was a random thing that came up off of my my plot twist cards from Paizo. That just kind of they stumbled into this direction. I'm like, oh yeah, okay, so they find this woman. Well, she now acquires them as her slaves and sends them out on missions. And so they do different stuff for her, and they wind up building power. So more than, I don't know if I'm making any sense, but rather than doing this dark, gritty, almost Shadowrun-esque kind of thing that I had in mind, they wind up gaining some magic items and some power, and they've leveled up a couple of times, and they're like, I mean, they're still, you know, escaped slaves, and they're still having to deal with this plot line, and I don't know if they realize it, but pretty soon, you know, they've actually just recently made their escape, but they've escaped with some powerful artifacts that some people are going to be coming looking for. So while they're going to go, you know, they're going to go save a kobold village now, and they're going to wind up in a position where they're doing some other cool stuff, but, you know, within a few sessions, somebody's going to come hunting these things down. Suddenly, these people that they have wronged in the past, God, I hope they're not listening to this podcast. I don't want to give anything away. But these people that they have wronged on their way out, because, sadly, the oldest child who's playing, the 16-year-old now, is playing a goblin, and he is playing evil, and he's evil. He's Belkar Bitterleaf kind of evil, if that gives you any idea. So in a fun way. But, you know, they've stabbed some people in the back, and they've done some pretty drastic stuff to get out. And the other players who are good, ostensibly, well, they're kind of going along with it because, well, he's the persuasive one. He's the bard with the high charisma. He's the one that does all the talking. He's got really good ideas and really good plans because, you know, he's the 16-year-old. The other two are younger. And so they've been kind of listening to him, and it makes sense. It's not like they're being evil themselves, but they're listening to him on their way out because, well, he makes good sense and he's getting us out and he's doing what we need to do. But in the process, you know, they've really screwed over some people on the way out, some fellow slaves that they left behind, a young black dragon that they managed to dispatch but not kill. The thing made its escape. The mistress that they were working for, and then the very powerful dark elf slave master that they stole the artifacts from, and then they got a lot of people coming after them. It's gonna be really cool. So I mean, again, There's an overall plot. I'm just there's not an overall plot. Overall, everything ties together is what I'm saying. But I'm not planning it out. I'm not looking forward to some movie plot or novel plot where you get this traditional story arc of, you know, you have to build up to this and this and this. No, I'm just letting it all happen organically. And a lot of times, you know, they hit a wall and I don't know what's going to happen next. I'm like, all right, guys, let's take a break for a while. You know, and then I just come up with, okay, if they're here, what would be a cool encounter to happen next? And that was a lot of what, as I come full circle now, a lot of what made me fall in love with D&D when we were kids is the idea of what would be a cool encounter. I remember me and my brothers and our friends, and we would be in these adventures, and it would just be, they wander into a dungeon for no reason. They wander from room to room, and as new rooms come up, each one of them is just me. I've been flipping through the monster books, and I've been doing some research, and I've been thinking about it, and I've just decided, God, you know what would be really cool in the next room? What if they hit frost giants? Oh, that would be awesome. Oh, I know. What if they were taken captive by deep gnomes and they were scheduled for execution and they need a way to escape? Ooh. What if it was a Time Lord? I mean, just stuff like that. As a kid, I never had any plot, any overarching plot, anything to tie it all together. It was just a matter of going from place to place going, oh, you know what would be cool? And then we went and did something cool. And so now I'm doing that in a similar fashion where, yes, I'm using a story that makes more sense and leads more logically from one thing to the next, but it's just an idea of me getting a chance to go, oh, you know what would be so badass? Yeah, that's right. What if they got to kill a dragon at their level, their third level? What if they got to kill a dragon? Because there's dragons that can be an appropriate challenge in Pathfinder for a third level group. And sure enough, it was an appropriate challenge, and it was dangerous, and they thought they were going to die, but at the last minute, they got the thing down to 2 hit points with a lucky critical hit from the barbarian, and boom, the thing escapes off into the water, black dragon, so, escapes off into the water, and now it's gone. And so they get to loot the thing's treasure and make off with all the gold, and of course, they've got to know this thing's coming after them, but it was just cool. They got to battle a dragon over water. It was awesome. I mean, they're like, you got to imagine, underground lake, like you're somewhere, like you're somewhere that you're going to run into Gollum at any moment as you cross an underground lake on a little tiny boat, and they're out in the middle of the lake, and suddenly splash, splash. They can hear the noise, and then now there's the swooping dragon coming down on them. And so from their little tiny boat, they're having to battle a black dragon, and they just barely made it out. And it was really cool. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm just giving them cool stuff to do. They are so loving this. They're having so much fun with it. I'm really happy. This is great. Did I make a point? Did I get anywhere with this? You know what? Let me look at the rest of the stuff that I had on my gaming table here. I do have one thing. While we were playing last night, we got, as the game wound down, it was just me and Darks and, Eli sitting around, chit-chatting online, until we finally got too tired to talk anymore. And I think it was Eli said, "Ooh, you know what? A couple of good questions for the Pod-O-Matic." And I didn't actually add them to the Pod-O-Matic list. But one of the questions he asked was, "Hey, game master or player?" And you know what? I've been having so much experience with both lately that I feel like I'm finally qualified to judge. And I got to say player. Wow. Would I rather, I mean, in my heart, I'm a game master. In my heart, I know I'm a game master. I've always been a game master. I've always run the games for everybody. And recently with my kids, I've rediscovered my love of creating and making that exciting story for them and putting myself in a position where I'm creating the story. I'm God and I'm designing all of this, and yet I get to be just as surprised as they are at how things turn out and what direction the story takes. And I'm loving this. I mean, there's so many times over the years that, you know, I've always loved being a game master. I've always loved running the games, but there's always been so many times that it gets to be kind of a chore. It gets to the point where it's, oh God, I got to come up with something for them. I mean, I can remember in high school, I remember my group begging me, "Oh, can we play? Can we play? Are we going to be able to play this weekend? Can we play this weekend?" I remember every time thinking, "Oh God, now I got to come up with something." And every time, you know, I would come up with something, when we would play, we'd have a great time. But I remember that during the week, that pressure of, "Oh God, what am I going to do now?" And all that pressure is gone. All I need is one or two really cool encounters, and if I can find a way to work those in, awesome. And if they take it in a different direction, then okay, give me 5 minutes. We'll think of something. We'll make it happen. I'll go to the random tables off of Instant Game. I'll go to my plot twist deck from Paizo. I'll go to something where I can just throw out random ideas and go, you know what? I can make something work out of that. I don't need to plot and plan forever. I don't need reams of notes to make this fun for a group of kids. It's perfect the way it is. I'm having a great time. But as much as I have rediscovered my love of game mastering, being a player kicks game mastering's ass. Oh, I love being a player so much. And I think I come up with a new character and I get into a game and I think that it's that character that I love. And I do love that character. Every time I love that character. But that's the whole point, is that every time, every character, I love them. I love inhabiting these characters and just getting a chance to play and be in someone else's story and just trying to make my way. I love being a player. There's nothing like it. If you're role playing, game masters, I love all of you because you have a thankless, horrible job. Yes, I know. I'm a game master too, and I have fun doing it. It's not like this is a joyless task, but it really is a lot more work and a lot more pressure. I mean, a lot more worry, wondering if everyone's having fun, wondering if they're, you know, it's just a lot of work. Being a player is so much more effortless. I mean, seriously, I got to update my character sheet once every couple of weeks, and otherwise I just show up and I have a good time. Oh, I love that. I don't have to design maps. I don't have to come up with tables. I don't have to determine how much treasure everybody's going to get or if that magic item is going to be too powerful or if I don't have to do any of that crap. I just show up and have a good time. Love that. Oh, man, there's so much more I could do, but really, I'm a half hour into this podcast, and I've done nothing but talk about Pathfinder. So, you know what? We're going to move on. What's the next thing? Let's see. It is... Oh, God, do I want to do that? No, you know what? I'm going to save that one for next week. I'll tell you what I'm saving for next week, by the way. It's the Science Corner, and the title is Throwing Cats Out of Windows for Science. Really. But we'll save that one for next week. So what is up next? Oh, here it is.
And now for something completely different.
Something completely different. It's just stuff I don't really have a category for yet. And this week on something completely different, Nurungi. Nurungi, if you want me to spell it, N-U-R-E-O-N-G-I, Nurungi. And Nurungi are Korean meat dogs. Obviously, we've all heard that, yes, Koreans eat dogs. Sure, lots of Asian cultures do. Lots of cultures around the world eat dogs. Why? Well, because dogs are a good meat source. And let me just start off right away that in the debate over whether or not you should eat dogs, I have no problem with people eating dogs. If we've accepted that it's okay to eat meat, and I have, all right, maybe you haven't, that's fine. But if you're going to be okay with eating meat, then a dog is just as good a source of meat as any other. You know, I mean, like I say, I'm okay with slaughtering cows and sheep and pigs for my meat. I don't see why I should be squeamish about killing a dog and eating it. And if I had a chance to eat dog, if I was in a place where dog was an actual available dish and... I'm not talking about going to some, you know, back alley dog stew. I'm just saying if I were in a country where consuming dog meat was considered normal and I had it available to me, like any other food, I would certainly try eating dog. I would be fascinated by that. I have no problem with eating dog. But what I wanted to know was, and I don't even remember how it came up, that something came up about eating dogs. And I was wondering, okay, so what kind of dogs do they eat? What breeds of dogs are being eaten? Because, you know, clearly, you know, pugs and chihuahuas are not going to provide a really decent meat source. So, you know, are they eating like St. Bernards? Are they eating like huge dogs? Is that where dog meat comes from? So I did a little research. And it turns out that in Korea, at least, the most commonly eaten dog is the Nurungi. It's their meat dog. Koreans do keep dogs as pets, just like most other cultures in the world, and they do not keep Nurungi as pets because they're not considered real dogs. They're meat. They're another word for them. I can't remember the Korean word for it, but another word for the Nurungi as a species of dog is shit dogs because they're mutts. They're garbage. They're intended as livestock and not for anything else. They keep all sorts of pretty wonderful dogs as pets, just as we do here in America. And they see those dogs, their pet dogs, as something completely different from the Nurungi, from the meat dogs. They would never dream of eating any of their pet dogs, just as we, as Americans, are horrified by the idea, usually, of eating somebody's dog, eating a poodle, eating a, you know, whatever. And so they have this separation. And the Nurungi, if you take a look at the pictures of them online, it's just a yellow dog. It's just, it's very, very typical looking yellow dog. Like if I saw it on the streets here, I wouldn't recognize it as any sort of breed. I would just assume that it's some sort of mutt, a very spitz-like build, more wolfish than a lot of your, especially your miniature dogs. It's got the elongated snout, the pointed ears up top, and it's just like you say, medium-sized yellow dog. And in fact, Nurungi means yellow dog. Or yellow one, or one who is yellow, or something. However, it translates. But basically, Nurungi, the equivalent on Wikipedia would be like naming your black dog Blackie, or something like that. It's Nurungi is just yellow dog. So, if you do get a chance to go to Korea and you do get a chance to eat Nurungi, if you get a chance to eat dog, you're probably eating Old Yeller. Just face up to that one. One of the other fascinating things, and I don't have like I say, this is just something I was looking up, something that I thought was fascinating. One of the other interesting parts about it is Nurungi are what are known as a land race of dogs. And land race means it's equivalent to being its own breed. They really are. I mean, they breed true. They are, you know, they're all this similar set of characteristics, but it's not like anyone made them that way on purpose. It's not like they were bred to be this big yellow meat dog. No, this just happens to be this group of dogs that's been used as meat for centuries in Korea have just acquired these characteristics. This is the kind of dog that they are, and they're all a single breed, but not an intentionally bred one. And so they, at least in Wikipedia, label it as a land race dog. And I'm like, that's fascinating. It's basically a naturally occurring breed that just this area has these dogs. No one made them that way. No one was seeking these attributes for them. This is how they came out. I just thought that was really cool. But enough about that. Guess what? It's time to get the little ones out of the room. Make sure you're sitting down for this.
Nerd rage came flashing back, and I just looked at him and went, "Rrr!"
That's right. It's time for some nerd rage. All right. Here's my rage this week. There is something under my keyboard. Oh, it's driving me crazy. It's been there for like a month. There is something, some crumb, some piece of dirt, a pebble. It's gotta be something solid. It has to be like a pebble. Maybe a broken piece of plastic. Something has gotten underneath the keyboard in my laptop. All right. And it started off being underneath the letter O, all right? And so every time I go and I would type, it would skip the letter O. I'd be typing, and I'd look up, and I'd realize, God, there's no O. What the hell? And so I'd back up, and I'd hit it, and you can get it to work, but you have to hit it a little hard. You have to push down. There's some resistance there. And then it moved, all right? And then it moved. It shifted over, and then it was under the letter P. All right, P's not so bad. I can deal with that. I mean, just got to be aware of it, right? And then after about 3 or 4 days, it had disappeared for a little while, didn't notice a bit, and then shit, now it's under the E. How can it be under the E? The most commonly used letter on my keyboard? Are you kidding me? Oh, and so this is the point. Once it gets under the E, this is the part where I'm like, okay, I'm a computer technician. I'm a guy who can do this. I should just take the damn thing apart. I need to unscrew it, pull the case apart, lift the keyboard out of there, and just blow out whatever the hell is under there. Because I've tried shaking it and tapping on it, and I even tried blowing it with the canned air, but this keyboard is tight. There's no space for me to really get under these keys and blow. I mean, in fact, if I did get it with the air, all I'd do is just move it to a different key. There's no way to get it out. And that's what I'm realizing right now. And so it was under the E for a while, and then I lost it for another week again. Okay, great. It must have dropped back, you know, maybe it's under a function key for all I know, or it's dropped back to the back of the case. All right, awesome. And then 2 days ago, it showed up under my Enter key. I thought the E was bad. I thought the E was the worst that this thing could possibly get. And now it's under my Enter key. And it's driving me crazy. I had to play Pathfinder last night. We play on Roll20. We've talked about this. By the way, Roll20 is guilting me into buying a subscription. So I think I'm going to do that, after this next payday. I'm going to go give them the $50 and I'm going to become a paid member of Roll20 because they're right. I use their service a lot. I enjoy it a lot. I'm not, you know, I'll be game mastering. Well, I'm not game mastering. I'll be running a game of Zombie Cinema here in about 3 weeks. So after Stan's game finishes up, I'm going to start doing some Zombie Cinema. And it's not a game that requires a GM, but I'll be the coordinator who actually sets up the board and gets stuff out there. And so for the things I'm doing on Roll20, I don't need the subscription. I don't need to have access to the dynamic lighting. I don't need to have access to set up character sheets. I don't need any of this bonus stuff for myself. But I need to give them the $50. I've used it enough. And in fact, what sold me was it popped up at one point. I log into Roll20. I'm going to do what I do. And it just pops up on the opening on my home screen. Here it is with a little message off to the side that says, "Hey, Mike, you've been playing Roll20 for 50 hours. Do you think it's time for you to give us some money?" I'm like, and it wasn't even as blatant as that, but they point out that I've put 50 hours into this system and therefore, you know, hey, doesn't it make sense to help support something that you obviously enjoy as much as you do? And I'm like, yeah, they're right. God, I forget you can just measure my time on there. So I'm going to give them some money because they deserve it. They deserve it. They have given me tons of joy. And in fact, at this point, I think I'm up to like 70 hours or something. I don't even know where to look that up anymore, but I have put a lot of time in on Roll20 and I love the system. But anyway, we're playing on Roll20 last night and the thing is under my enter key, whatever this pebble is, this rock, this boulder under my enter key, so that every time I go to type anything, you're doing online chat, so a lot of times it's a race to get your comment in because, okay, something comes up, you want to comment on it, even if you're just going to make a joke or you want to do your reaction to it or whatever, you type in quick and then you have to hit enter and you have to get in fast because not that you're trying to beat other people, but you kind of are, because if someone else gets in, well, shoot, now there's two other comments, so now, crap, my comment doesn't make any sense unless I go back and I add in something at the beginning to indicate who I'm speaking to, or I have to have some clarification now because the posts have moved on a little bit. And when there's something under your enter key, and so your enter key doesn't work two times out of three, I missed a lot of stuff. I wound up getting in there and I type and I go, bam. Oh, crap. It didn't go. Bam. Bam. Oh, it didn't go. And then it's like, oh, crap. Now it's too late. All right. Let's go up and edit. And you know what? It's not worth it. I'll just sit. I'll just wait. I'll wait till my next turn. I'm good. And so the enter key is driving me crazy. I can deal with it anywhere else. I mean, I'm typing up a Word document. I'm working in, well, Excel, it's a little bothersome because Excel, I'm so used to just, when I'm doing strings of numbers and calculations, I'm so used to going, paste, tab, enter, go. I mean, it's so quick to move from space to space. And to realize that when I'm moving that fast to set up something in Excel, it's gotten to where it's faster if I just use my arrow keys instead of my enter to move down. But I keep forgetting to do that, and so I keep missing stuff, and I wind up typing over the things I'm doing. I'm going to have to take my laptop apart. That's my rage. I'm going to have to take my laptop apart, and I don't want to, because every time you do something like that, you just run the risk of breaking something. I mean, that keyboard is connected by a bunch of wires, and if I pull this case apart, I'm going to have to find where that connects and unplug it gently. And inside of a laptop, the connections are not as nice and solid as just plugging a USB port into the back of your desktop, tower. It's all delicate on the inside, and there's just so much chance of breaking something that, I hate to have to do that. Maybe if I just tip it over and hit it some more, maybe that'll work. Maybe I don't have to take it apart. Maybe I can just drop this rock back to the, No, it'll wind up under my mouse pad or something next, and it'll wind up breaking things. I don't know what to do. It's so frustrating. But having finished with my rage, you know what it's time for? It's time for the badass movie quote of the week. Or, more specifically, it's time to retire the badass movie quote of the week. Yeah, I gotta retire it. This is episode 51. I've missed a couple of them. I've done almost 50, badass movie quotes of the week. And it's gotten to the point where they don't bring me joy any longer. I'm not, I don't feel like they're as meaningful as they once were. Back in the beginning, I had, a whole ton of quotes that I was in love with and I wanted to share them with you guys. But now sometimes I come up with, I'll be watching a movie and I'll go, oh, there's an awesome quote. Jot that down, write it. But a lot of times if I haven't run across something Well, now it's a matter of, okay, let's go scour some old lists. Let's do some searches. It feels like work. And a lot of times I'm just finding, you know, it's a lot of times I feel like I'm settling. It's like, oh, all right, there's one that'll work. I can make that one work. That's good. And I don't want to settle. I want these to be exciting. I want them to be vibrant. And so if it's not going to bring me joy, I'm not going to do it. I mean, I can still do badass movie quotes. And I might, you know, I mean, I'll still call them the badass movie quote of the week, even if they're only coming out once every couple of months. But I'm going to retire this bit. So from now on, we're just going to go straight from meticulously plotted straight into Podomatic, and we'll have to skip over this segment. But as long as I'm retiring it, I will end on a quote that I have used before. It was probably the first one I did. I haven't gone back to listen, but I'm going to guess it was the first one that I did. And it is still my favorite movie quote of all time. Quote, "Hello, my name is Inigo Montoya. You killed my father. Prepare to die." End quote. That's it. That's the best movie quote ever. That scene, the final scene, and I'm sure if you go back and listen to the one where I used this quote before, I give this exact same speech. That end scene is one of my favorite scenes in all of moviedom. He's finally confronted Count Rugen, and he's matching him. Well, you know, the Count, the six-fingered man, it winds up almost destroying Inigo Montoya right there. And he stabs him here, and he stabs him there, and he slashes him. And we go through this whole bit, and then in reverse order, no, not even in reverse order, in the same order, Inigo matches him wound for wound. He finally gets his energy back. He's repeating that quote over and over. Gets his energy back. He's dealing back the same wounds that he received in order. And he ends on that, you know, promise me anything I want. And the Count says, all that I have and more. And of course, Inigo says, I want my father back, you son of a bitch. And then finishes with the final wound through the chest. Count's dead. Inigo wins. Good guys are all happy and we cheer. Or, you know, if I were the kind of guy who cheered in a theater, I would have cheered. I love that movie. I love that scene. My favorite quote ever. So that's the retirement of the badass movie quote of the week. Which means it's time for the told you I had the cough. Bomatic. All right. This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. I haven't rolled down to see the script yet, so. Oh, here we go. Holy blueberries! This is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 in his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where do these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? Then you send your question or topic to me by email, or better yet, in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to the Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. The other question from the other night, from last night, that Eli asked and said, oh, this would make a good Podomatic question too. He said, what's your favorite noise that R2 makes? And I will tell you right now, I don't even have to think about it. My favorite noise from R2 has always been, it's one of the original 7 or 8 noises, whatever I had before I discovered that he has all these new ones. It's the one where, he beeps and then he does a long scream. The scream, and I think it, I don't know if this is actually what happens in the movie, but it, in my mind, I always picture it as R2 is now loaded into the back of an X-Wing unit, Luke is flying, and they take a shot, and they take some damage, and right after they get hit, R2 makes that screaming noise. All right, and I'm going to – hold on. Let's try. No, it's not that one. Oh, so look at that. He didn't even beep first. I thought it was a beep and a scream. No, it's just the plain old scream. That's the one. I love that noise. So that's my favorite R2 noise. But that means that R2 has rolled up a 74, which is from a listener named Zimny Pot. Am I pronouncing that correctly? And he asks, a surprise volcano erupts in your backyard while you're at work. How will you react when you get back home? Holy crap! I don't, A surprise volcano. Yes, that would be a surprise. I do not live in a volcanically active region. That would be a huge surprise for northeast Nebraska. But depends. Depends on how big it is. Does it hurt my house? I mean, it's a volcano erupting. I mean, are we just talking a mini volcano? Or, because I'm pretty sure that if I was at work and a volcano erupted in my backyard, I only live literally, as the crow flies, it's about 4 miles from where I work. So, not even that. Got 2 miles. So if a volcano erupted in my backyard while I was at work, I would be covered with ash at work. I would know about it. I'm not going to be surprised when I get home because I'm going to have seen it on the news already. So if it's just a regular sized volcano, I mean, are we talking, and it depends on what kind. I mean, are we just popping up a fissure in the earth that's leaking out some hot lava into my backyard? I mean, like it's created a new in-ground lava pool for me. Which would suck because it would take my tree. I've got the biggest tree in the neighborhood. I've got the biggest tree within a couple of miles of this place. And, I mean, the tree is quite literally 7 or 8 foot in diameter. I mean, you know, big enough that it takes, 7 or 8 foot is probably an exaggeration. 6 foot in diameter? Yeah, about 6. Because it takes maybe 3 or 4 of us holding hands to circle all the way around this tree. It's big. And that tree provides shade for my entire very large backyard, shade for my house. It would suck if that tree went. I mean, it's smack in the center of my backyard. I would hate to lose that thing. I would weep for my tree. But, you know, assuming my house was still here, there's got to be a way to parlay this into 15 minutes of fame, right? I mean, you know, as long as it's not going to destroy all my stuff, I'd be sorry to lose my tree. But, man, I would have the coolest story to tell forever. I mean, who's the stand-up comedian? Is it Brian Regan? Is he the stand-up that says that nobody beats an astronaut story? All right? That you're at a party and this is, yeah, it is Brian Regan for sure. You're at a party and no matter what kind of douchebag you've got there who's just waiting for his turn to throw in his story about how awesome he is, doesn't matter what story you've got, the astronaut in the room trumps that. Doesn't matter. In fact, the astronaut should make it his job to just wait around for the douchebag to tell his awesome story and go, "Oh, really? I walked on the moon." And then that beats everything. Okay. The miniature volcano in my backyard story, that gives astronaut a run for its money. Honest to God, in living in Nebraska and to be able to tell people, no, remember that time? Remember that time that the volcano popped up in a dude's backyard and there was like this lava pool right there in the middle of the frickin' neighborhood? You remember that? Yeah, that was me. Oh, I'd have that story forever. That would actually be kind of cool. 95. Serious Paul. Do you like chocolate-covered strawberries? No. No, I'm very particular about my fruit. I'm really stupid that way. Fruits and vegetables, I have a texture thing. I love the flavor of strawberries. Strawberry flavor is wonderful. And if I eat strawberries, I recognize that I really like the flavor. But something about the texture of strawberries, I don't know why, it disturbs me. I have a tough time eating them. Just the same with grapes. Same with a lot of fruits. Oranges. Apples. I love fruit flavors. I love the taste of them. And yet, something about chewing them up, there's something primal going back to my childhood that I can't do it. And it disturbs me. So chocolate-covered strawberries, yeah, not doing me any good. I'm sorry. Number 21. Ooh, this Zimney Pot character has another one. Have you ever made out in a movie theater? Man, I would imagine that I have. I mean, I dated a little bit back in high school and college. I took girls to movie theaters. God, you would think I've made out in a movie theater, but I can't remember a single instance. And if there's any ex-girlfriend of mine listening or my wife and you remember an instance where I did make out with you in a theater and it was really hot and I apparently have forgotten, so I'm kind of a bastard for not remembering that wonderful moment that we had together, I really, really apologize. But I don't remember. God, I'm thinking I had to have, but I don't really think I ever did. I don't think so. Man, that's a good question. Number 12. 12 hails from a guy named Kyle who says, if you could roller boogie, would you? Oh, God, yes. Oh, my God. Yes, of course I would. Roller boogie. Yes, if I... Okay, hold on. His question goes on. Are you jealous of those who can dance while roller skating? Of course I am. Who wouldn't be? Oh, I would love to be. I would love to be able to dance at all. And you would think that it's one of those things that, God, you know, I should go out and get some lessons. I should learn to dance. I should practice dancing. I would love to be able to dance. I just can't, and I don't. And again, this may be, you know, something from my childhood where, do you remember being, at the roller rink for the class event, and you'd go out there and all the kids are there, and you're spending all your time wondering if you're going to get up the guts to ask the girl to skate during couple skate, and you're going to, and of course I never did because I was a loser. And you would see the people, especially, it was usually girls, but sometimes dudes could do it too, who could skate backwards during couple skate. You know, one of them could skate backwards and they could hold each other rather than just holding hands as they go around. They could actually go around, you know. Anyway, I was always jealous of that. The ability to skate backwards, the ability to dance while skating. Oh God, yeah, that would be so awesome. So awesome. I would love to be able to dance in general. I am always envious of people who can dance. And like, I remember at my brother Kyle's wedding, my cousin Rob was out on the floor dancing and he was just goofing around. I mean, he wasn't even taking it seriously. He was just having fun. I mean, he was intentionally trying to look like a goober. All right. But even while he's trying to look like an idiot on the dance floor, you could just tell that he knew how to dance. The rhythm was there. The moves were there. And so even while he's trying to be over-exaggerated and goofy, it was just clear that he had natural dancing talent and he was good at it. I was so jealous. And I've always been jealous of that ability, that just move and look good doing it. Oh, man, I wish I could do that. Number 6. Huh? Oh, all right. This one's from a Zimney Pot. That's new. What is your favorite type of Star Trek alien? Man, we have had a lot of alien questions in the last few weeks. Last time, because I've done what's your most favorite alien, what's your least favorite alien. So what's your favorite type of Star Trek alien? And again, as I said last time, Star Trek aliens, for the most part, really bug me because they're all just humans with facial appliances on. They're intended half the time as they are plot devices. So you get a race who has whatever unique look they want to slap on a race for this week. And then they have some stereotypical quality that everyone, I mean, all Klingons are warlike. All Vulcans are emotionless and logical. And they give it whatever characteristic they want to be the stereotype for that race, so that they can prove whatever point it is that they're proving about the human condition in this episode of Star Trek. And not that that is a bad process, but I prefer more three-dimensional aliens than that. And I'm gonna actually say that I think my favorite alien is, and I'm not gonna say a race, I'm just gonna say Spock. Spock from the new movies. I don't like the J.J. Abrams Star Trek movies as much as I like original Star Trek, but I do like Spock. I love Zachary Quinto. Is it Quinto or Quinto? Quinto. I'll call him Quinto. I love Zachary Quinto's Spock. I really like the fact that he is half human, half Vulcan, and that they let his emotions play a part, that he's still Spock and he still does that Spock thing. And yet they're also giving an interplay of his emotions in there as well, to show his human side. I like Spock. I like the way they portray that because again, it's taking something that normally would just be stereotypical that, yeah, okay, even though the original Leonard Nimoy Spock was half a Vulcan, he might as well have been all Vulcan as far as he was played on screen. He was that stereotype, and all other Vulcans were a lot like Spock. I mean, it wasn't, you know, there wasn't any big surprises when it came to Vulcans. And so seeing Quinto's take on it is giving me a more three-dimensional look at, and I mean three-dimensional in a J.J. Abrams movie. I mean, let's not get too crazy about it, but I like him. I like him, and I like his portrayal. I think it's really good. So there you go. Number 55. All right, someone new. It's from Zimney Pot. Zimney says, lobster tacos or lobster pizza? I'm not a big fan of lobster. I mean, if you're going to give me the choice between those two, then I would go lobster pizza. I've tried lobster. To me, I'm not a big seafood fan in any case, so lobster is not anything really special to me. Lobster to me is best when it's soaked in lots and lots of butter sauce. So I'm tasting more butter sauce than I am lobster, really. Lobster makes way more sense on a pizza for me than it does in a taco. I don't really have a defense of it because I don't think I would enjoy either one of those things, but the pizza's the one I would pick if I was forced to pick. Number 56. Oh, right next to it. This is from Kyle. Kyle says, I've been working on my three-word cringe story. Three-word cringe is all capitalized and it's in quotes. So my three-word cringe story. Sandpaper dental floss. That's a pretty good one. I remember this game. And that's one that, all right, I say sandpaper dental floss. And you're not cringing yet as a listener. Okay, now, stop for just a second. Pause the podcast if you have to. I need you to picture yourself with sandpaper dental floss. And I need you to picture yourself using it. I mean, actually, visualize that as well as you can in your mind. It is setting my teeth on edge just trying to describe it to you guys. Oh, that's a good one. Sandpaper dental floss. He finishes his question with, so what you got? Oh, okay. Well, since I remember this game, my favorite of those cringeworthy visualizations, and I can only do three words. Oh, it's slow moving. If I hyphenate slow moving, can I make that one word? We'll just use slow. I suppose that's good enough. Slow testicle vice. There you go. Yep, that's right. But you have to picture it. For those of you without testicles, I apologize. This isn't going to work very well for you. But for those of us with testicles, that is a cringeworthy story in three words. Slow testicle vice. That's my favorite sound. This is number 70 from Zimney Pot. Do you have a cool idea for a crop circle? Wow, what a great question, Zim. I do not. I am fascinated by people who put in the effort to do these huge geometric crop circles. Although the problem I have with crop circles is you have to sneak in the middle of the night and ruin somebody's crops. I mean, you do understand that the whole point of doing a crop circle is you go out there with your ropes and your boards and your other tools, and you walk down some poor farmer's crops, and so you make your cool crop circle by bending all of his crops to the ground, and you're going to ruin a lot of produce that way. You're going to ruin a lot of crops. You know what's even more impressive to me than crop circles? There's a guy who does the same sort of thing with snow. He goes out and essentially he gets on his big old snow stomping boots and he walks out essentially crop circles but in the snow and marks out these huge, huge geometric patterns that fill. And they're precise and they're gorgeous. And I don't have a good name for them other than patterns in the snow or snow crop circles, or I don't even know what you would Google to find it. I just know Yancey was showing it to me, and there was a whole list of these things. And they're incredible because you look at it and, you know, like with crop circles, the easiest way to do a basic crop circle is you just have an anchor in the center. So you mark your center of your circle, your pivot point, and then you just walk it off with a rope so that you're holding onto the rope and you know that if I walk the circle at this radius, then I've got a perfect circle. Nice and easy. Really simple to do. And then, you know, you can build more complex patterns from there, but you can use your rope to kind of mark yourself and figure out where you're going so that you can keep it all even. Well, on the snow, this guy doesn't have that option. He can't mark it off because if he's got rope or any other marker that's dragging through the snow, it's going to mess up the fine surface of the untrod snow, as it were. So what you're looking at when you see these patterns he creates is you see these beautiful, huge geometric shapes of where he has walked these out. And so you're just looking at him flattening down the snow in these patterns. But the stuff in between is pristine. It's beautiful. And so he's doing these huge hundreds of feet across, like built into hillsides so that there's like angles of the terrain that he has to account for. And somehow he measures these all off perfectly. Like, you know, even if I had it all plotted out on paper and I know that, okay, I have to go off at this angle and I need to do exactly 43 boot lengths in this direction, am I going to be able to keep that even? Like even enough so that when I make a full circle or square around this field, that it's all going to meet up at the other side and everything's going to come out exactly right? I could not do that to save my life. I can't even imagine how much practice this takes. And this guy does it. And I think he's Scandinavian. I think it's like in Norway or Denmark or somewhere around. I think this is where he does his work, somewhere where there's lots of snow, which is requirement number one for this project. But he does these things, and as I'm looking at it, I'm seeing these gigantic things. The precision of them astounds me, and the idea that when you look at his finished products, you know, all it would have taken is for snow to start falling again. I mean, he's got this beautiful field of snow, and if it started snowing again, then, you know, he's halfway through, and now the snowfall has smudged half of his pattern that he either needs to rewalk or he needs to give up and start over. Or, for God's sake, a deer or a rabbit crossing through here would leave a set of tracks. I mean, when you look at this pattern from high up, any animal that happens to cross through this area is going to leave a very visible trail, a very visible line straight through the middle of his pattern and ruin the whole thing. And I mean, the chance, I mean, this is more delicate than creating sandcastles. I mean, at least sandcastles, you know, you've got a certain amount of time before those waves start coming up and getting you, as opposed to doing this in the snow. Something could happen along at any moment that would ruin the whole thing. And yet he's creating these perfect, huge patterns without even, I mean, here he is on the ground. He can't even see, you know, 80% of the rest of the pattern from where he's standing. He just has to go by whatever mental map and drawings he's got in hand. It's really impressive stuff. If I find a link, if I can find these pictures again, I will provide some sort of link. But, man, if you run across them, they are worth looking at. The guy is impressive. Number 74 is a volcano question. Hold on. Number 18, still from Zimney Pot. Zimney asks, is water too wet? Well, you know what? No. Water is exactly as wet as it needs to be, I think. I would, on the scale of wetness, whereas 1 would be too dry and 10 would be far too wet, I would place water right about a 6 or a 7. I mean, in a generally accepted, that's pretty wet. That's wet enough. That is just about right. I'm going to give you that. Although when you ask the question, one of the first things I think of is I once heard a description of soap and how soap acts, by saying that soap helps clean things by making water wetter. That you make your water, wet more. The action of the soap, as soap dissolves in your water and you get your lather, your suds, the soap mixed with the water gives the water, it's become slipperier. I think it's something about breaking up the surface tension of the water, so water is less likely to bead up and more likely to penetrate into whatever it is that you're trying to remove dirt from. Something like that. But again, the author that was describing it actually used the phrase, soap makes water wetter. And I don't know if that's an accurate description, but it's telling me that at least by this guy's assessment, water could get wetter than it is. And so right now, no, I don't think it's too wet at all. I think it's just about right. Number 88. This is from Kyle. Kyle again. Kyle said, have we had anyone but... we did Kyle Zimney. Was there a Stan in there or a Paul? I can't remember. Kyle says, you have to pick one noticeable scent to put in the Glade plug-in that you keep powered up and attached to your belt for the rest of your life. Assume you can create any scent that you want. What is it? My gut reaction is vanilla, because I find vanilla to be a very pleasant scent. But I also recognize that vanilla maybe is not the most alluring scent if I want my, if I want to be romantic with my wife. Maybe vanilla, while it might make her hungry, may not make her more in the mood than other choices. But I also recognize that whatever scent I pick, I have to wear it on my belt, powered up for the rest of my life. I will then become accustomed to it, and I will be unable to smell whatever that smell is forever. So there's two effects here. One, this is what people will think of whenever they encounter me, is this scent. So it has to be something pleasant to be associated with me, but something that I don't mind missing out on forever. So I'm going to say whatever Nathan Fillion smells like, because I think that would work for my wife. Number 6 is, from Stan, who is not Zimney or Kyle. Stan says, who would win in a three-way fight? Xena, Sirius Paul, or Steven Seagal? Oh, this is a great one. First, Steven Seagal would get his ass kicked, because we've specified that the three-way fight is between Sirius Paul, an actual person and listener of this podcast, who is obsessed with Xena. Steven Seagal, who is a fat actor who thinks he's a martial artist, but isn't really. And Xena, a fictional character with magical powers. So, therefore, Xena, clearly in this scenario, Xena wins. Because, one, I don't think, with his obsession, I don't think Paul would be able to fight Xena. I think he would take more of a worshipful attitude. After he finished destroying Steven Seagal, he would then probably allow himself to be taken down pretty quickly by Xena. I'm going to guess. Now, if instead of Xena, it's just Lucy Lawless dressed up as Xena, then Paul takes all comers, because Paul is a prison guard in a seriously badass facility. At least he was last time I spoke to him. And even with a messed up knee and other issues that he may have going, prison guards don't muck about, all right? They, Joel is a former prison guard. And from people I've talked to quite extensively who have been guards, trust me, they know how to take a dude out, and not in any nice way. I mean, you know, even if they don't have access to their tasers or their pepper spray or their whatever other tools that they may have available to them, even without those, they know how to take a dude out. They're looking to incapacitate as quickly as possible, and I think Sirius Paul would be really, really good at that. So assuming fictional Xena warrior princess, Xena wins. Assuming just ordinary human beings and actors, I go for the prison guard every day. Number 82. This is from Zimney. Zimney says, why doesn't glue stick to the inside of the bottle? Because most glues that you're familiar with, like Elmer's glue, just as a nice easy one, or rubber cement, or most basic glues operate by drying out. That's really their whole mechanism, is that the glue gets in place, and that's why if you spill glue, if you get glue on yourself, if you wipe it off immediately, especially if you wipe it off with a wet rag or something, it'll come right off. All right, glue is effective when glue dries. Once the moisture evaporates out of it, it's the residue that's left over that holds everything together and makes it stick. And thus, you know, things like paper that are very porous, you know, Elmer's glue works great sticking two pieces of paper together. Not so much when you're just using it to stick your fingers together, because your fingers, while you get it some stickiness where it's gone into your fingerprints, into the grooves and ridges and natural landscape of your fingers, you're still easily able to just peel that out, and then you get that cool little fake Elmer's glue skin that you get to peel up. Oh, I love that. Who doesn't love getting Elmer's glue on their fingers and then getting to peel it off? That is the most awesome. So in general, it doesn't stick to the inside of the bottle, because as long as the bottle is sealed, then there's no air in there to dry out your glue, and therefore it stays liquid and it doesn't stick to the inside of the bottle necessarily. I mean, it'll stick a little bit, like it's a viscous liquid. It'll have a little bit sticky, but no, you're not gluing the bottle. That's why there's other glues that are epoxy type stuff. The things where you have two ingredients that a lot of times you'll see them in a specially made, you know, two chamber bottle, and you push the plunger and then the two liquids will come out at the same time and then they mix. Those bond by a completely different agent. Those don't necessarily require drying out. They once they mix, their chemical reaction causes them to harden immediately. And those two, if you mix them together inside the bottle, would in fact stick to the bottle, and they'd dry out and become a solid rock in there if you had them mixed together. That's why they have them in two chambers. And so those particular glues, they don't stick to the inside of the bottle because you haven't mixed them together yet. They haven't activated, as it were. This is my understanding of glue in general. I am not a glue expert. If we have any glue experts in the audience who would like to finesse these details for me or correct me, you are certainly welcome to chime in. But otherwise, I'm pretty sure I'm on target with these. Number 46. We'll make this one the last one. This is from Kyle, who says, Pathfinder critical hit question. I use the critical hit deck. Some weapons score crits on 19 and 20, and some do x3 crit damage. How do you handle that with your critical hit deck? I'm sure Paizo has rules about it, but I never read them. I want to know how you handle it. Okay. This would be a great question for me if I had a critical hit deck, which I don't. I wish I did, but I don't. A critical hit deck and a critical fumble deck would be a lot of fun for me. But I have seen Darks use it in our Rise of the Rune Lords campaign, and I know he's using a critical hit deck on his end. And here is how he's house ruled it, and I think this is dead on. This is what you should be doing. First off, the crit range won't matter to the deck, because the crit range is just determining what rolls score a threat, and thus, you know, you go to confirm your critical. So the range doesn't make any difference whether you've got the deck or not. However, for weapons that have x3 crit damage or x4 crit damage, what Darks ultimately house ruled, because we have a fighter with a scythe in the group. Holy crap. And I think the scythe is x4 on crit damage. And so it seemed unfair that he would be pulling a card from the crit deck, and he's getting whatever awesome crit effect is there, which may be double damage or triple damage or bleed damage or constitution damage or some other horrible effect, from the deck itself. But it seemed unfair that the scythe wasn't getting the full bonus. The whole point of buying a scythe is you get reduced damage in general. But man, when you score a crit, you score a crit. Holy crap. And so what he decided to do, and I don't know if this is in Paizo's, facts. I don't know if this is in the instructions for using the deck, but what he decided on was that the critical hit deck is used exactly as is for anything that has double damage. If it's just listed as a standard times 2 on the crit, then you just use the deck as is. If it's listed as times 3 or times 4, then you take whatever the deck says plus one extra multiple of the. So if you've got triple damage, then you do whatever the deck says plus one extra multiple of damage. So if the deck says double damage, you make it triple. If the deck says quadruple damage, you make it quintuple. You know, you just add one extra level of crit because a times 3 weapon is one extra level of crit. Times 4 would be two extra levels of crit. So if he came up with an amazing crit out of the deck, and this result comes up amazingly with 4 times damage, and your weapon already has 4 times damage, well, then you bump it up 2 marks to 6 times damage. That seems to be a really, really fair application, so that advantage of the weapon, that one extra level of damage on crit or two extra levels of damage on crit, that advantage is still applied to the deck, and then you can still use whatever the deck says. And it seems to work out actually pretty well. So I got no complaints. If I had a critical hit deck from Paizo, that is exactly how I would use it. Which means it can only be time for a recap. You there, GLaDOS?
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
"No way."
And then I was all, "We pretended we were going to murder you."
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2014 by Nerd Pride Radio. The opening and closing theme is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. My bumper music this week is Weezer's In the Garage, and it was going to be She Blinded Me with Science as performed by William Shatner, but I decided to put off the science corner, with Throwing Cats Out of the Window until next week, so I didn't actually use that one. However, all of these songs are available on iTunes. Check them out, buy them, enjoy them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them, each and every one. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes and write me a nice review, or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Stop at the Facebook page, click the like button. It is 9 seconds out of your day. You can do that for a buddy. I know you can. Don't forget to check out all the free games I have available on my free games page. There's Instant Game, Animal Ball Melee, Sandbox Hill, 2/3 of a dozen others, all free, all the time. And you know, I say 2/3 of a dozen others, I haven't actually counted them. That's just a number I made up because I thought it sounded cool. But I think there's about 11 games there total, something like that. If you want to contact me, you can always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com. And I promise if you do, I will actually respond to you. But to be totally honest with you, the best way to talk to me is to come and sign up for my forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. You sign up there, you send me a message, we will hang out together, we will be best friends forever, we will have fun. Oh, wouldn't you know it came up to that one. I just realized I never did set the switch back over to the other side, so all we got was the original 7 or 8 noises this week. But that's okay. R2 does not mind. This one is number 86. It is from Talvin. Talvin says, "Besides Roll20, what other online or electronic tools do you use for your RPGs?" All right. That is an excellent question, Talvin. I love Roll20. I have sung the praises of Roll20 multiple times in this podcast. I am going to give Roll20 $50 this week so that they will stop guilting me into giving them money. I just want them to shut up about it, really. Roll20 is awesome. Back in the day, me and Kyle and our cousin Rob and Jeff Hawes played, I think it was WebRPG. Was that the name of the service? A very similar kind of service tabletop RPG. Did not have quite the flexibility and amazing stuff that Roll20 has, but it was a cool service, and it's sufficed for, what, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, however long ago it was we were playing. And we did that for, and actually we didn't just use it for, we did use it for playing D&D, second edition transitioned into third edition. But we also used it to run some instant games and a couple other little things. We had a really good time with WebRPG. But currently, electronic and online tools that I use for my games, I keep all character sheets online in Excel spreadsheets, every one of them. I love Excel. I love having easy access to it. And when we play, probably about once a month or so, for my kids, or when they level up, or when something drastic changes, I'll print them out new versions of their sheets. But they always have printed copies in front of them. I love having the printed copies, and the Excel design I've got has wonderful, wonderful color and a great layout. And the magic of the internet and Google image search is that there is no excuse to not have a really great character picture. So all of them have character images right there on their character sheet that they love. They help pick them out, and they love the way their characters look, and they're really proud of them. And in fact, I'm thinking, man, I'm getting a little off topic. I am thinking we use the map and the miniatures when we play here with me and the kids. And for miniatures, we almost always are using miniatures from the HeroScape sets, because I have hundreds of them. And since we don't play HeroScape very often anymore, no sense in letting those miniatures go to waste. They're beautifully painted. They're really cool fantasy and sci-fi figures from all sorts of different genres. They're really cool looking. And so we use those. The problem with them is they're built for larger hexes than my map, which means I have 1-inch hexes on my map, and if you set a dude down on a hex, the bases of HeroScape figures, the circle covers the entire hex. It doesn't sit inside the hex. It covers the entire, right out to the edges of every point of that hex. Or if I use the square side, same thing. It overlaps, and spills out over into the nearby squares or hexes. And so therefore, it's really tough with a lot of Pathfinder's, tactical stuff when you need to know, you know, exactly where someone's standing, how to, there's all sorts of little things about it that you can't put them all together. Like if you've got, you know, 6 different combatants all locked together in a combat, you can't get them all together. You can't put them all on the proper hexes. They kind of just bunch up, and then it's hard to tell who's standing where. And so I'm thinking to solve that, speaking of the really cool online pictures, is I'm just going to get some cardstock, and I'm going to print out some little standable figures that have their character portraits right off their sheets. And I'll just print out some of those, and then, you know, you can fold them and stand them up, and then they'll have little stand-up pictures of themselves on the board, and they'll be thrilled with that. I'm going to do that. I really want to. And then that way, you know, it's not like there aren't millions of places that you can get pre-made sheets to print out for various different monsters. You know, fold them, stand them up, nice and easy. Or, for that matter, once I've got a standard template for it, there's no reason I can't go find cool monster pictures and just copy-paste them into my sheet and have pre-made figs whenever I need them. That would be awesome. But in addition to using Excel, I don't use any kind of online dice roller. I don't use obviously I do for Roll 20 because it's all online. But when I'm playing in real life, always use real dice. I know some people really enjoy having apps and I've had apps on my phone that'll roll dice for me. That's fine. But there's no joy in that. And having a physical set of dice is so pretty and so easy to do. And I've got a zillion of them. I have buckets, literal buckets of dice. Why would I not use real dice? But let's see. Excel, Roll 20. And other than that, it's the online resources. One of the things I love most about Pathfinder, and I have spent a lot of money on Pathfinder books. I support Paizo 100%. I have bought tons of stuff from them, even though Paizo gives me all of their information for free online. I mean, all the information I have in these books, except for the most recent ones, like usually there's some kind of gap or delay before they put all the information online. But in general, all of the information from all of the books I currently own is available online. I don't even have to have the books. I wouldn't have had to pay $200, $400 for all these books. I don't even want to know how much money I've spent on Pathfinder books. Mostly I get them as gifts, so I don't know how much I'm really spending on them. But I wouldn't have had to spend that money. I could certainly use them all online. But I like having that available again. You know, that way with my laptop, I don't have to carry all the books with me. I like having my books. I flip through them. I read them all the time. I'm so glad I own the physical copies. I'm glad I can give that money back to Paizo so they can keep doing what they're doing. But at the same time, the convenience of having it all on your laptop, that's probably the biggest electronic resource I use for gaming, is just, especially for Pathfinder, having all of my system reference stuff right there online. You can go to paizo.com, and they have their system reference document with all of their rules on their website. Or if you go to pfsrd.com, that's pathfindersrd.com, pfsrd.com has all of the stuff that Paizo has, and all of the third-party stuff, and they're better about doing links between stuff. So every single reference in any particular, you know, I go to the Bard entry, and everything under Bard that can possibly link to somewhere else, they've got the links already built in. You can go get it, and they include not just all the Paizo stuff, but a lot of the third-party and fan-created stuff. There's so much information available. I like using Paizo. I was just saying this to him last night while we were playing Roll20. I use the Paizo site most of the time for straight up character building, just because I don't want all the third party stuff. I don't want all the bells and whistles. I don't want all the clutter. I just want to see the basic set of rules. I like being able to go to the feats page and just see a list of the basic feats from the core rule book. Whereas if I'm going to the Pathfinder SRD, I go to the feats page and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of feats there, and to sort, and most of them are specialized feats created for this or that or whatever. All I want to do is see the core feats. I don't want to do anything fancy. Same thing with the equipment page, or same thing with, there's a lot of things that having the Paizo site is so much nicer, because it's just straightforward, it's straight out of the books, the layout's a little easier to get around. I like doing that. But then, you know, I want to do a little bit of research, I want to find something unusual, I can go to the PFSRD and just do a search and go, for example, my character just picked up a whip. I've decided I think, you know, I get some weapon finesse and then maybe a feat for, you know, improved trip or whatever it is that goes with it. And suddenly this whip in the hands of this tiny non-combat character, really, the whip could be moderately effective in a couple of levels if I take the right feats. And so I got that information from looking at the Paizo site, but then I go over to the PFSRD and I just search for whip. And now it's showing me, you know, a list of like, you know, 10 different feats that can be applied to the whip that if I wanted to go that deep into it, and I don't, I'm not going to go crazy on it. She's not about combat. The whip is just a sideline that I want to take two feats. You know, the weapon finesse will help her with the whip and with a bunch of other stuff. So that one's cool. That's a general purpose one. And then just one feat, whip feat later on, and maybe a second one way down the road if there's an opening for it. So I don't want anything too fancy, but the idea that I can go to the PFSRD and I can do a search for whip and get a list of all these options and open up stuff that, oh, you know what? I wouldn't even have thought of that. I could do that if I wanted to. So just fascinating. So both of them serve different purposes. I have both of them bookmarked and reference both of them on a regular basis. Like at the same time, I have both of them open at this. Usually if I'm working on characters, I will have both those sites open at the same time and I'll go to one or the other depending on what my particular need is at that moment. That's my biggest stuff. I'm trying to think of other electronic stuff that I use for gaming. I think that is about it. Roll 20, just Excel and Word just for creating stuff, and then the online references. Love the online references. And of course, also I have a lot of games and documents and stuff that I've bought that came in PDF format only, so that counts as an electronic resource too. I have a lot of game books that are only on my laptop. So there you go.